Hi, and welcome to She's the Boss Leaders, the podcast all about successful female founders and women doing amazing things in business from Australia and around the world. I'm your host, Jules Brooke, and this episode is sponsored by Brand for Brands, a branding agency run by two sisters located in Sydney. They specialize in building and refreshing brands that speak to the right people, the ones that will invest in your products and services. I hope you enjoy the episode. So Wendy Squires is a media expert. She's a journalist, she's a storyteller, and she has had the most extraordinary career. She's worked on magazines such as Mode and Elle. She was the editor of Clio and Australian Style. She's been senior editor for a squillion other magazines, and she was the head of publicity for Channel 9 at one stage. So I'm absolutely delighted to be talking to her today about her career. Welcome, Wendy.
Hello, Jules. Good to see you.
Good to see you too. So let's kick this off with what you're doing these days. So can you let everyone know what you're up to now? And then I'm going to bring you all the way back and we're going to talk about all the amazing things you've done.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm in lockdown, so I'm not doing a great deal, but work-wise, I'm writing for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. I've got a bi-weekly opinion column for them, and I am working for some corporate companies. I help them translate corporate speak into more
normal language. Exactly. Okay. Great. Okay, so you're out there doing all sorts of things, but talk to me about what set you off on the whole idea of journalism in the first place? Because I know that it's pretty much been a passion for you forever. Talk to me about how it all started. How did you start this amazing career?
Well, I didn't really ever have that pining, yearning feeling about being a journalist. I was remarkable. I finished school. It was a bit of a tough go there for a while. The last year or so, I was my own legal guardian, and that was quite challenging.
That's extraordinary. Hang on, just talk to me. How do you even become your own legal guardian, and how long did it last for? Was this sort of the end of high school?
Yeah, the last year of high school, pretty well. I was actually homeless at the time. It was a pretty rough time, you know, sleeping on beds, friends' bed, you know, bed couches and spare bedrooms.
I can't even begin to imagine what that was like. So what a start. But, I mean, I guess
awful.
It's what you... Yeah, I can... Yeah, I bet.
It was really awful, yeah. So
you managed to get through year 12, though?
I did. I got through year 12. My boyfriend at the time hocked his guitar, which I am forever grateful, and saw me through. And I got through, and then I didn't know what to do. I was obviously working because I had been on my own for a while and had to sort of, you know, make a living straight away. But I did see an ad in the paper for copy people for News Limited.
Okay.
And I thought, oh, that could be fun. I was quite good at English at school, and I, you know, I'm pretty curious. So I applied, and then I got a letter back saying that my application had been disregarded pretty well. I wasn't going to make, you know, even an interview process. So I got angry about that, and I thought, well, bugger you, I'm going to call up and find out why I didn't make the process. So I called up the number of the man who had sent me this form letter, and luckily he wasn't in. He was on holidays.
Right.
And his PA, she said, what are you calling about? And I said, oh, the copy people interviews. And she said, well, they're on Saturday. And I went, yeah. And she said, so be there at midday.
Oh, my God.
Okay, I'm just checking my names on the list. And she said, I can't see it. And I said, well, I've got the letter here. And she said, well, just come in. And that's how I actually became a copy girl.
Oh, my God, you're so tenacious. So what did you say when you turned up, though? Did they say, hang on, you're not on here? Or how did you bluff your way through it?
I just bluffed it. I borrowed a dress and, yeah, off I went.
No. Right. So
I was one of the longest ever copy people at News Limited.
Oh,
I didn't get a go before other people, which was really annoying.
Well, tell me first, just for those of us that don't know, and I'm one of them that don't know, what is a copy girl? What does a copy person do?
Okay, it's a slave, really. We don't have them as much anymore. You'd probably call them interns now.
Right.
But in those days, we didn't have to be qualified. We sort of, you know, they kind of got grunters, if you want, you know, for want of a better word, people with some guts. And so what you do is you go in there, and in the old days, they're called copy people because in the old newsrooms, they'd call copy, and you'd have to run and take it down to the printers.
Okay.
So when I got there, that was all phased out, and copy people were basically, I'd go and put on people's bets at the TAB. I would pick up their drug.
Oh, like the gopher.
I'd run and get files. Yeah, I'd do, you know, sort out the news and deliver it all, you know, make coffees throughout the day. And it was a crazy time, but all of us who went through that copy girl, copy boy into the cadetship program, I'm sure are incredibly grateful, because it was a great, really great grounding
experience. And a great way to, I guess, get sort of suss out the lay of the land. But how long does a copy girl, or a copy person, I should say, normally go, and why were you, how long were you? Like, when you said you were the longest, what did that mean?
Almost 2 years, and I was writing the whole time.
Wow.
Which was really annoying. And anyway, one day one of my great early mentors went to the editor and said, why aren't you giving this girl a cadetship? And I had terrible acne at the time, which was my absolute, you know, a burden to me in every sense. And I was told that they couldn't send me out looking like that. So not only was it sexist, it was also lookers.
Yes.
Because none of my male... Yeah, none of my male contemporaries with the same issue had any problems with it. And eventually I got a cadetship, because you would be a copy person and then you'd have to sit exams. And I sat the exam. Pretty well they'd told me if I didn't get in this lot, then I should give up. And I didn't get in again.
Oh, wow.
One of my best friends at the time, though, had been also tried for the rival paper, the Sun, and he decided he'd go to the Sun. So there was one left, and they gave it to me as sort of a consolation prize, I think.
Oh, well, thank goodness they did, because look at your career. I mean, God, that, you know, Matt, the thought of you not getting in. So you become a cadet journalist. What does that mean, and what? How long were you doing that? What was the next step?
Okay, so within News Limited in those days, there were lots of papers. It's Daily Mirror, The Sportsman, Sunday Telegraph, Daily Telegraph, and The Australian. So it's a great system in that I got to work every round, rounds being from real estate to finance, sport, entertainment, opinion, parliament, courts. I worked a different round on every paper.
Wow.
And just kept revolving around and around. And so it was a really, really great learning experience. And talk about learn by the seat of your pants. These days I teach journalism, and if I had had the skills that we teach students, I would have been a lot better than I was, a lot earlier than I was, especially I think in sport and finance.
Much. I couldn't think of having to write about that, and they go, well, you know, it's part of the job. Sorry, go and find out about
it. It was a struggle. Yeah, it was a real struggle. Well, they on the sports desk, they all had a laugh because they knew that I was not sporty at all. So my first ever sports assignment was the Greyhound, covering the Greyhound races at Carroll Park.
Oh, my God. Right.
And, of course, I didn't know anything about it. I'm not, for one stage, I didn't have glasses in those days, and I thought it was a real rabbit, and I was so offended. But anyway, I learned that, you know, you just, everything is a learning lesson, and you can't overcomplicate it, because at the end of the day, it is a set of results. One, you know, one dog won, one didn't.
Yeah, yeah. There are people who are really interested in all that kind of thing. So, so great grounding across all those different magazines. So where do you go from there? Is the idea normally that you kind of land on one of them and go, this is the one I want to work on? Or?
Yeah.
Right.
Well, you get cadetted. So usually a cadetship took 3 years in those days, and I would have to pass 120 words a minute shorthand, because it's still the case that only a shorthand written notes can be taken in court.
Really, even now, legally, I would have thought that was dead.
It's
dying out. Maybe
it's still a rule, but it just needs to be changed, because obviously now they have TV cameras in court. So it's pretty crazy that only a shorthand note will take up as a record of what you heard.
Absolutely,
it did make sense in the old days, though, because you couldn't take it down quickly enough. It's been known that you can't take it down quickly enough with normal longhand. So, I got my 120 words a minute, and then I got cadetted to the Australian.
Oh, that's a big prestigious newspaper for a young girl to get started on. Yeah,
I was terrible.
I would have thought.
And I had shone as a cadet at courts and entertainment writing, and I decided I wanted to be a court reporter. So I moved to the Daily Telegraph. They wanted a court reporter there. So I did that for quite a while, and then I let it get on top of me a little bit. I did one too many pedophile trials and it really started to affect me quite badly. So another great mentor of mine, Jerry Sutton, who just died a year ago, bless her, she thought that I had real talent. She said, come and run the entertainment section with me. And she ended up being my best friend and my sister and my my great mentor for 35 years.
Oh, that's so, just such a great story. And can I also say that you decided to go on and do entertainment, which is, I would have thought, a no-brainer in terms of being much more interesting. So what happened then?
Yeah, oh, courts is pretty interesting. it was great. In the 80s, working at the TV networks had so much money to spend. It was ridiculous. And it was all about Neighbours, and we'd get flown around the country. And I was living in a squat with all these uni students in Fitzroy Street in Surrey Hills at the time. And it was hilarious because a limousine would come and pick me up, you know, with champagne in the back to drive me to a private
party. And were all your friends kind of going, let me take you to the airport. Party.
Oh, my God, they're all yelling out the window, steal whatever you can and bring it back. They were crazy days, but really great days as well, and important too because it, a lot of money rode on it. It was an free-to-air was an extraordinarily important part of newspapers in those days, and still those stories sell to this day.
Right. So then what happened after working there? Because I know that you had a stint in New York. When did that come about?
Yeah. Well, I fell in love. And I wanted to go to London. And I said to him, let's go on an adventure. I've always wanted to live in London. But he was over the age where you could still get a visa as part of the Commonwealth. So he said, let me go to my editor and say I want to transfer and I'll see where we can, you know, I'll see what I can do. Well, he called me and said, I got the transfer, but it's to New York.
Oh, darn it. And
I didn't, well, I didn't think I'd ever be able to get a visa.
Yeah, right.
I also didn't feel that talented or comfortable in my my journalism that I could make it over there. I knew that, you know, Australians couldn't get a job without a green card pretty well. And then I found my way around it and I got something called an I visa, which means that you can work in America, but you can only take an international's money.
Oh, okay.
So, you can't be taking an American.
But so you can live there, but you had to be employed by someone in Australia.
Yes, okay. I had to sort of be sponsored pretty well by someone in Australia. So I had $2,000 in my pocket and a round the world ticket would stop in every city in Europe because
amazing.
I hadn't travelled very much because I thought I'd never be able to do this trip again for, you know. So we were going to hopefully, if I couldn't live in New York, we would see each other and I'd base myself in London was the plan. But within 2 weeks, I had spent every cent I had.
I can totally relate to that. How could you possibly not enjoy everything about New York?
I started to freak out. So I went to the Australian embassy to see if they had any jobs. And they said, oh, I hear that there's a job going in the New Zealand consulate. So I went in there and there was a job in the library there and I went, they went, yeah, we'll sponsor you. So I was jubilant. And that day I was supposed to be catching up with all of these people based in ACP, which was the big magazine stables.
All right, yep.
And so I called them and said, look, I'm out partying. I just got a job. I can live in New York. Woohoo, I won't be in today. And they said, no, come in. And they came in and they offered me an even better job. So I became a syndication agent for all of the magazines back in Australia.
Oh, wow.
So it was everything from Picture and People to The Bulletin.
So is that like the New York Contact? So that you're just providing all those different magazines with stories? Is that kind of how it works?
Yeah. Oh, right. So I would buy reprint rights and, you know, reprint photographic rights. I get to talk to Hunter S.
Oh, my God. Who else? Give me some more fabulous names.
Oh, my God. Well, what happened was that we would try to buy the rights to a story or an interview, but if they couldn't get it, the magazine couldn't get it, they would say, well, you're a writer, why don't you try to get it? So that's how I really started writing, was I just thought, yes, hell yes. So I ended up interviewing amazing people over there, Harrison Ford and Winona Ryder and Johnny Depp and
oh my God, you really kind of honed your skills, didn't you? And to get into them, I mean, all the story all the way through so far, Wendy, is resilience and bouncing back and whatever. So you would have been fantastic as a journalist, not taking no for an answer.
I'll put it this way. I got used to bluffing really early on in the piece. But the other thing was, Jules, I think very much from my background, I had a real fire in me to show everybody that I wasn't going to end up.
Yeah, stuff them all.
You know, it was pretty tough getting through that last year of school. And I know people, you know, were talking about me, and I just really wanted to show that I had something and I wasn't going to end up a no-hope or
well, look at you. I mean,
whatever was put.
Yeah, fantastic. So you're in New York. Were you still with the boyfriend at that stage?
Yeah, we lived very happily there. And unfortunately, I fell more in love with New York than him in the end because he said, I want to go home. And I went, oh, no.
Bye.
This place. Like, bye.
Oh,
bye.
Poor love. Right, so how long did you end up staying there?
I stayed there 3 years.
Wow.
But we actually sort of stayed together. So eventually his mum was dying and a lot of stuff had happened to me in New York where, you know, moving, and a very dear friend of mine was killed, and I just thought, I don't know, maybe it's time to go home and touch base again. So I came back to Australia, which was interesting because a lot of my friends from newspapers would never mention the fact I'd been in New York. It was like something that was just...
Oh, they would have been green with envy. I mean, everything that you would think. Oh, absolutely.
I didn't see it at the time. It was really quite hurtful. And especially having lived in New York for that long, I mean, there's a whole different attitude in New York in about supporting people, especially professionally. And every time I got I remember when I got my first byline in the Bulletin, which I never thought
would ever get.
And I remember telling my friends in New York who didn't even know what the Bulletin was. And they ended up having a party for me that night to celebrate my first byline in the Bulletin. Like, they were so encouraging. So it was very strange coming back. And the only place I did find that, you know, my experience over there was really respected, and that was in the magazine group. So I decided I'd go and try magazines when I got back and not go back to newspapers, as I'd always predicted.
And you were still within the fold of the company. So you weren't out of work. It was just trying to find your next fit.
Oh, no, I was out of work. It was a separate company. That was a syndicated agency sort of. So they didn't own the company that had hired me to be their syndication agent. They were just a client. So I did have to come back. But luckily there were two great women. Mode is a magazine that used to be around in the 80s.
And I remember 90s, it well.
It's probably still my favourite. Oh, I loved that magazine. That was my dream, to write for Mode. And I had written a lot for them in New York. So when I came back, the editor there said, come on as our staff writer. And I did that for a while. And then I was offered features editor of Elle magazine, which had just come to Australia. And it was such an international title that I've got to be honest, I hoped it might have got me back to New York at some stage. So
I'm glad that we didn't lose you, actually, because I reckon if you'd gone back one more time, you may never have come back here.
Oh, well, I did. I've gone back a dozen times since I left, and I tell you what, I still probably would move there tomorrow.
Oh, well, I'm glad you're here. But so tell me what life was like working in the magazines in those days, because they've done TV series and things about, you know, new idea and all the rest, but what was it really like?
Well, I knew Nene quite well, and I love and respect Nene King, who, if anyone doesn't know who she is, you should... you should actually interview
her. Oh, my goodness, I'd love to.
What a woman. I'd love to introduce you to her because she's got great stories to tell. It was amazing in those days. I went through the supermodel. After Elle, I went down to Clio to work with Lisa Wilkinson, who I thoroughly respected. So I sort of did all the beginning of supermodels on Elle, and then really we were supermodel central on Clio.
Amazing.
And then it was sort of the Royals, and you know, it was really exciting time.
Especially as well, because there were so many women that were in power positions in those days when that wasn't actually reflected across any other kind of industries or most other industries.
To a point, there were lots of women.
Yeah.
But then the very top, there was that ceiling was male, and it was male to the very end, unfortunately. Although great other mentors like Pat Ingram, who I adore. She currently edits Sunday Life, which I write for. What a great role model and mentor she was as well. Some fantastic woman, Lisa Wilkinson. I got to work with Mia Friedman, who is one of my best friends to this day. I'm godmother to her only daughter, which makes me very proud.
You should be.
Deborah Thomas, amazing people. Oh, amazing.
Absolutely. I mean, they're big names even now. So what happened after you'd done Mode and Elle? What was the next step?
So I went down with Lisa to Clio.
Oh, sorry,
and
Clio. Yep.
After a couple of years there, I realised that, look, I'm not the Clio girl. You know me, Jules. I'm not sort of the...
No, it's very girly. It's very girly and kind of light.
It was a bit too girly for me. But I adored Lisa and I loved working with her. And then one day she turned around and told me she was pregnant. And I went, uh-oh, because I've just accepted a job at Who Weekly. And she said, no, I want you to edit Clio. So I knocked back the job at Who Weekly to take over Clio from her. And it was just at the time when everything was beginning to slide with the internet. I didn't really want to do it. So I didn't last very long. And then I went to Who Weekly.
I love that magazine.
Which was amazing because Who Weekly, if you don't know.
Yeah, go on.
Yeah, well, it's actually People Weekly in America, the biggest selling weekly magazine in America. They couldn't call it People Weekly out here because there was a People Weekly, which was the men's adventure magazine.
Adventure, let's say. Yeah, it was all the girls with the, wet T-shirt competitions, shall we say.
So it was really interesting working for the Americans, and I realised how different it was than how I'd learnt in magazines. And I loved that job. I did all of their special issues, best and worst dress, weddings issues, intriguing people. Plus I was the entertainment editor again. And I really got to edit some great stories. So it was a really great experience. But then I got a call one day and I thought it was one of my friends teasing me. And it was saying that Lachlan Murdoch wanted to take me out to lunch.
I would have thought it was someone teasing me as well. I mean, how old was he then? I mean, he was very young and handsome, back in those days.
I'd say he was probably...
Was he married to Sarah? Is it Sarah? No.
No, okay. I went to Sarah's hens night because I became quite friendly with them. No, he just started dating Sarah.
Early 20s?
Early
30s? Okay.
I don't know. He's a bit younger than me.
Right.
No, it would have been early.
Okay, so.
He was lovely to work with.
But tell me about this. So, anyway, you get invited out for dinner with Lachlan Murdoch.
Yes, so I said I couldn't go out that day. Can you tell Lachlan I can't go out because I've got lunch with Nick Cave that day? And then I hung up and then I got a call back saying, no, Lachlan really does want to meet you. He's John Hardigan, who was the CEO of News Limited, has suggested that you edit this magazine he's just bought. And the magazine was Australian Style and it was Lachlan's first ever private investment.
Wow, so that's really significant.
And especially anything media. Yeah, I was really stoked. I got on very well with Lachlan. I absolutely loved the magazine. He couldn't, because it was such a small magazine, I mean, I literally wasn't.
Right.
We would get a computer, rental computer for 2 weeks so I could close the magazine. Otherwise, I just took my old...
So even though it was such a big company, they didn't give you a whole lot of staff.
It wasn't a big company. Right. It was Lachlan, and he bought this with a woman from Perth. It was a very small investment.
Right.
I mean, they hadn't even invested. It was me and a telephone line, pretty well. But it was great. That magazine was a wonderful magazine, very well respected internationally. Launched great fashion, great photographers. We didn't pay them anything, but because it was published by a book publisher, the tear sheets that people got were so great that it got them a lot of great roles. I mean, we had the one of my stylists ended up to style for Harper's Bazaar.
Ooh, that's a big one.
A lot of those early photographers went on to America and did some work. So it was a really beautiful magazine. And so Lachlan, to keep me on that magazine, also got me to go to the Sunday Telegraph. So I was half paid by them and half paid by News Limited. And that was around the time that they wanted to start Body and Soul. So I created that.
Are you talking about the insert that's in the Daily Telegraph and the Herald Sun today, yes. Body and Soul? Amazing.
Yeah, on the weekends. Yeah, it's 20 years.
Yeah, it's a good insert, actually. It's really good. Going.
Yeah, so I created that for them and then I helped with the Sunday Telegraph. I kind of redesigned the back and then the Olympics were coming up. So my work was getting really divided and eventually I decided, look, enough, I can't do both the magazine. It wasn't growing at all because there was just no investment in there. So I decided I'll go back to News Limited full time.
Okay.
And that's when I did all their Olympic publications. I did all their special projects like motoring magazines, Body and Soul. We turned Body and Soul into a TV show. It was great fun.
And the buzz really of the Olympics, if you were there in Sydney in that year, it was so amazing, wasn't it? Yeah.
Well, they actually put me as the head of their hospitality. Oh. So I checked in at the Siebel Townhouse, which was the ground zero. I checked in Kissinger. I checked in all these incredible people because it was hospitality for all of Rupert's friends.
Oh, wow.
All over the world came in.
Incredible.
So it was the most amazing time. And at the end of the day, all these tickets were left over because some of them had doubled up. So I just called my friends and said, I'm checking out and I've got a, you know, I've got a handbag full of tickets. So we'd all go to there and saw everything. It was those Sydney Olympics.
They were. They were.
It was such a great experience.
I totally agree. So what do you do after you know, Olympics are over? And you've been doing all these special stuff.
Everything was starting to go downhill in those days. Like the internet was starting to really eat into everything. And I'd gone through quite a bit. I'd lost my mum. I lost my dad. Quite a bit had happened to me personally. And then one day I was at a dinner party with some friends and I met I was talking about TV ideas I had for TV shows. That was Mia Friedman again. She was still in magazines editing Cosmopolitan at the time. And she told the publisher of all of ACP Mags about my ideas. He's a guy called John Alexander.
Right.
A lot of people criticised John. I really enjoyed working with him as well. Anyway, he said, apparently he had listened to what she said and then one of those phone calls came again. It was about... from David
Ginn. Okay, these are all very big names.
EA. I know. And he was running, well, he was just about to run Channel 9 at the time. And he said, come in, David's heard that you've got some great TV ideas.
Oh, my God, what a dream.
I'd love to
have the head of a network ringing and go, hey, you had some good ideas at a dinner party the other night. Come on in. Your heart must have been beating out of your chest.
It was crazy. Oh, talk about bluffing it again. So I went in there with this list of TV ideas and David and I got on really, really well. And he said, look, I want you to come and work with me beside me. I want to womanize, like female, you know, make Nine female friendly.
Womanize was actually probably the right word, you know, come to think of it, but go on.
Oh, well, that's probably, So there were all of these things. And I said to him, because after all the Olympic stuff, there just wasn't that much for me to do at News Limited. And I said, look, I'll go, but I have to have a proper job, David. You know, like I don't want you to just put me on some job where I'm going to tread on toes. And then about a month later, I got a call back from him saying, okay, I'll head up. Oh. I went, yeah, I can do that because I've been, you know, I was so involved in TV, you know, in the 80s.
What a massive job.
That's a great way for me.
Massive job.
Yeah, I wish he'd told everybody else I was running for the job, though, a lot earlier because I knew about 5 months before I even went there that I'd got the job. So the day I resigned, all my staff came in one by one.
Oh, wow.
So it was a really bumpy start to what was a really shitty year, to be honest. I got out of there the day that my contract ran out.
Oh, what a pity.
I didn't enjoy
I have to say... Go on, you say it and then I'm going to give you a little rap
You know what resulted? I ended up writing a book called The Boys Club, loosely based on my experience.
Yes, and that was really kind of my first experience of you because my really, really close friend was the head of marketing for the publishing house that did your book. And I remember we were sharing, it was just after the Olympics, we were sharing house and she came back and she said, oh, my God, we're doing a book called The Boys Club. You're just going to love it. And it's with this awesome woman called Wendy Squires. And then I didn't meet you for about another 15 years. But, yeah, I remember that book and I've still got it on my bookshelf at home.
Well, let's just say it was I launched it.
You did. It's a little bit cross, I think, behind that.
Look, it was an amalgam of all of the sexism I've received in my career or I've endured or witnessed. And I did try to make it humorous. It was a novel.
It was a novel.
It was very loosely based. But after that experience, I just really wanted a break. I was worn out, really burnt. But I got lured back to ACP magazines because my dear friend Paula Joy was starting up a magazine called Madison, which was such an achievement because it was half ACP and half the Hearst organization.
Oh, right.
So
yeah,
basically
right.
The first time an American organization ever asked Australia to start a magazine. magazine that could be syndicated. And it was a great time. And I was the executive editor on that. And sitting beside me as the other executive editor was Lisa.
Oh, what Wilson. Fun.
So we got to work again together, which was amazing. We got the magazine out. It was a fantastic magazine. I absolutely loved it. Paula fell pregnant in the middle of all of this. So she was off for a year. So I stayed sort of on there to see that through. And at the end of it, then I sort of bounced around the magazine group, doing bits and pieces for different magazines, Woman's Day. I did a lot of feature writing for the Australian Woman's Weekly. And then I just, again, I just got in that lift one day and thought, I've been doing this for too long. I just felt burnt out. And I wanted
as soon
to change.
As soon as you make,
so I put my
as soon as you make that decision, though, I think, too, I can't do this anymore, whether it's to start a business or to go and move to another state as you did, or whatever it does that makes you change direction, you do look at it afterwards and go, thank goodness, but it is pretty shitty at the time.
Oh, it's terrifying at the time. And I'm on my own. Like, I have to earn to live. So it was absolutely frightening. But and I actually got to a point, and I would tell any woman this who's in this situation, you shouldn't be feeling awful, depressed every day because of work. You shouldn't be driving home. I drive home some days and tears had started running out of my eyes with the groundhog day monotony of it all. I had burnt out, and I still was terrified about money. So I got to a point where I had no choice really. So I put my beautiful bulldog in the back of my Mini and I drove down to Melbourne and I started again. I also knew that if I'd stayed in Sydney, because I was kind of known in Sydney, I'd never be able to freelance. I'd always be wanted in an office. And I didn't want to be in an office anymore. I find it extraordinary that they make creatives sit at a desk
because it's not how we work. And hopefully out of the pandemic, one of the more obvious things that will come out of it is that employers will realise that, you know, it's fine to work from home and that people are, and they've found that, haven't they? I mean, they've found that people are super productive if you just leave them to their own devices.
I've never missed a deadline in my career, but, you know, I don't need to do it at 9 to 5. I don't need to have the monotony of that commute. I'm so much better to go home and write it when I'm in a good frame. And that's, I think, that I really hope that gets recognised, because it's changed my joy of writing in a way too. I get to write when I'm inspired. I don't feel I have to just be sitting there typing because I'm watching. Very strange.
It is, but talk to me, because a couple of the journalists that I've been speaking to have said that a lot of the journalists that are used to being, particularly on newspapers where they're used to being in the office, are seriously struggling with having to work by themselves, which I find kind of weird, because I would have thought that they would love that. Have you been hearing that kind of thing as well?
Oh, I completely get that. I do. But they're a little bit further along. I think that there was a time when I couldn't have survived without being in a newspaper office either. I'm of an age now too where I just want to have a calmer life. I don't want a lot of stress in my life. And I'm after Channel 9, I'm not really very good at being
I think maybe that's one of the things I love about you. Well, it is one of the things I love about you. So so these days you're writing a column for the newspapers here, aren't you? And I do, when I occasionally buy the Woman's Weekly, often the big stories are by you. So you're still doing kind of juicy stuff.
Oh, not lately, but I still do the occasional stuff for the Weekly, I still write for Sunday Live. I teach journalism one day a week, which I absolutely adore, at Macleay College. I do a few corporate gigs. I just try to stay afloat, really. Like, I wouldn't say that I'm the most flushed I've ever been, but I'm probably the most content in my career. That's something I'll tell everyone as well. Never be afraid to take less money, because you're going to find you don't need as much. And I know that sounds a terribly trite or entitled thing to say, but I am on my own, and it is true. I have survived somehow. The work will be there. It's very difficult to I feel trite, or I don't want to be condescending in saying that, but it does come. I thought for it I'd be able to live maybe a year in Melbourne freelancing, and it's 10 now. And there's been some tough months, but
I worked in newspapers as well, and I had a boss, I'll never forget it, I was on the advertising side, so I didn't get to do the lovely editorial, but we had a boss, and there was a group of probably 6 or 7 of us. We were on the Sunday Observer and then working on some of the local papers, and I never, ever forget my boss saying to me, opportunities don't happen until you let go. And I thought, what is she even talking about? But it just keeps coming back to me time and time again that people aren't going to offer you work if they think you're employed. People aren't going to say, hey, let's do such and such, because they'll think that you're busy. So the moment that you do let go and go, okay, I'm up for opportunities, it can throw up some pretty juicy stuff.
And it also gets you out of your world. I mean, the newspaper world's very, very small in a way that we all work around each other. But, for example, some of my greatest enjoyment has been working for you and handling PR, meeting all these incredible entrepreneurial women, people like Pinky Mackay, who just sent me a most beautiful message yesterday about a story I'd written on the weekend. I mean, I've loved that. I've loved broadening my horizons like that. I've kind of honed my craft down now that I feel I've got something to give back, and that's really important to where I'm at the moment, is I really need to be feeling I'm contributing something other than saying that, you know, this handbag is a
must. Yeah, and I can understand that.
When it's $1,300 and it's not a
must. Well, your column in the Fairfax newspapers on the weekend very much sort of delves into much juicier issues than you know, what colour the handbag is and that kind of the awful thing that I'm hoping is going to come out of the pandemic, which is we don't care, you know, what you look like on the outside. And it's obscene to spend $20,000 or $200,000 on a handbag or a car or, you know.
I completely agree. I've been feeling that way for such a long time, which is again why I had to get out of that glossy world, because I find it spirit destroying in a way. And I never really fitted in. Again, like the sort of, you know, can't afford Chanel and I didn't go to private school. And there was a lot of that I found in glossies. There was also a lot of great girls that had, you know, really worked hard, but there was a certain expectation for you to be
this
image that we created. And it's just absolutely.
So, yeah, no, I agree. You know, here's a question.
And I never felt good about myself when I was in that. I always felt I was being judged, and I don't want to be judged on my bloody handbag. I've got to.
Yeah, I hope that it will all change. But, you know, that's just led me to, I'm going to put you on the spot now. Talk to me about what do you think is happening with the media, or what's going to happen in the future, because it all seems to be, in my opinion anyway, breaking down. All the old kind of ways of doing things just aren't working. So what do you reckon? Because I think women like you and really good investigative journalists, but those of you that really know how to write, you know, I don't think it's going to die, but it's going to come up in a different format, I think.
Again, I'm hoping something happens out of the pandemic with this. Yeah, everything has changed. And for a while there, a couple of years ago, I thought awful about facing my students, and they were all so clever and hopeful. And I just thought, oh, my God, there's no jobs for your kids. Like, I feel awful even trying to make out that there are, but I do not feel that way anymore. I feel that things are, diversifying. Look at it, for example, yes. This channel. Ticker TV, let's look at, you know, News Limited, Axed, all the regionals, but now all these entrepreneurs are coming up and starting online. I believe that the internet is it's a ravenous beast that cannot be fed
exactly.
Words. Every website needs content. So yes, there are great opportunities out there. Getting them to pay is going to be interesting, but I think that's going to be part of the progress of all of this, that it will filter the good from the mediocre. I hope people want to be informed still. I was very heartened to hear that apparently, I mean, COVID maybe not so, but before COVID, that the print...
Yes, well, I heard the same thing from digital marketers who are saying now printers are popping up and going, you know how we all hated junk mail, so everyone moved to email. Well, now everyone's drowning in email and print is going to come back. So who knows?
Yeah, it's going to pick that whole magazine world I get asked about. I just don't think mass market is ever going to be as mass market as we remember it. We can't keep up with the internet. You can update something in a minute. So a weekly magazine or something, or a monthly, is going to have to diversify. So I don't think we're going to see those big cirques anymore like we used to. But I believe print will stay. I think there'll be a lot more like coffee table books.
Yeah, interesting.
You know, that if you're into rock climbing, there'll be a rock climbing annual or something. It will still come out in print, and then, of course, there'll be online to back it up, which is going to constantly need words and updating. So I'm quite confident about the media. Mainstream media, not so much. I hope people understand the necessity it is to go to a masthead that you respect, like the ABC or Fairfax, or you don't not – do not, please do not trust your news to social media. That's my greatest terror. I think social media is an absolute blight on society.
And sorry, I have to laugh. I mean, it is and it isn't. But, yeah, certainly I wouldn't want to trust it as my news source.
It's great and it isn't.
That's for sure.
No. And I also think with Instagram and a lot of the stuff I write about women's self-esteem and young girls and stuff, and I really do think it's like constantly having 1,000 magazine covers at you every day with real people that don't even look like that. And everyone I know that is, in the media know that they don't always look like that. So it's just all this sort of manipulation worries me. But social media is an amazing marketing tool. It's here to stay. I think it can be
for good, yes, for good.
The greater good.
There's opportunities now, I think, and that's one of the things that I want to do is start getting normal women hosting TV shows, not looking like they're all dressed up and glammed up to go out to a nightclub, rather than to just go to work during the day. And we have fat ones and thin ones and tall ones and short ones and different coloured skin and different abilities, and I don't really care. I think hopefully let's talk about what's in your brains. Let's talk about what you say. Let's not worry about how you look.
And
yeah, all those kind of important things.
Because don't you that's right. It's not about the length of my lashes, although I've got a mono brow now.
Oh, my God.
Been kind.
Look at my hair. I mean, I'm like, I haven't been able to dye it. I think for anybody who's watching, we've been locked down now for, it's got to be seven months. And then certainly since the hairdresser, it's been a couple of months. And I'm going to have to stop doing the show or wearing hats or something.
Oh, I know. I look like Groucho Marx. I'm telling you, it's just awful. But,
Who cares? I don't really care at all.
Who cares? The thought of putting makeup on again to me is just, every day. I just kind of, I don't know. I hope this is all going to be better. This is who we are. And I've loved that about Instagram and stuff during COVID too, is a lot of people.
Yes, at last.
A lot of people have stopped filtering. Sharon Stone did an amazing a plea to camera because her sister's got COVID and her sister's husband, and they're in Florida, and it was cruel. Like, I don't know if I think I would have walked around the garden looking for better light than that. But she came on, and I just remember thinking,
I saw
this is great. This is exactly what Sharon Stone looks like. This is what a woman her age who is well-deserved looks like.
And Annie Lennox has done it. Annie Lennox has been doing some as well, and she just looks amazing. I mean, not retouch, not anything, but she just looks great. And it's so important what's coming out of her mouth as well. Well, listen, Wendy, this has just been, as it always is with you, just the most fantastic interview. Can you let people know, if they do want to get in touch with you and follow your columns and things, where can people find you?
Best place, Bobby, is my Facebook page, Wendy Squires Writer. I always try to reply to anyone who posts to me there, and that's where I put up all my published work. Or else just go to The Age and type my name in and they all come up as well.
Or Google. Just Google and there'll be stats there.
Or otherwise, watch me host.
Yes, on the She's the Boss channel. Bring it on. Okay. Thank you so much again. Now, for anybody that's enjoyed the show, please would you subscribe to the channel, like, make comments. There should be a couple of other shows here on the left, so click on them and watch them, because all the women I'm interviewing are amazing. If you want to know more about She's the Boss, go to shestheboss.com.au. I run Zoom lunches every Friday. We've got podcasts. We've got all sorts of things happening and a big membership base that's growing. So I hope I will see you again. But if not, watch out for the next show, and I hope you enjoy them.
Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this episode. Another big thank you to our sponsor, Brand for Brands Agency. To find out more about Brand for Brands, go to brandforbrands.com. To watch this or any other episodes in this series on video, go to the She's the Boss YouTube channel. And to find out all about She's the Boss, how we are making female founders more visible and lifting up the women around us, go to shestheboss.com.